a lot of people's wondering, what is the blues? I hear a lot of people saying the blues, but I'm gonna tell you what the blues is. When you ain't got no money, you got the blues. When you ain't got no money to pay your house rent, you still got the blues. A lot of people holler about, I don't lack no blues, but when you ain't got no money and can't pay your house rent and can't buy you no food, you damn sure got the blues. That's why it's that.
Well, hey there, Vinyl Guide listeners, and holy moly, you guys are in for a real treat, especially those of you who love blues records. We have an incredible couple of shows on hand for you. This week will be part one of a two-part interview with John Tefteller. John has spent much of his life buying and selling rare phonograph records and has a worldwide reputation for having the best and the rarest records in the world. And while John collects many different styles of music, his personal favorites are pre-war blues 78s. John was recently in the news for spending over $37,000 for a single rare blues record. You guys are in for some real fascinating tales from one of the most committed record collectors in the world. And in addition to that, the Vinyl Guide is partnering with Sundays Music to give away some free records to lucky listeners of this podcast. Stay tuned into this episode to learn more about how you can get some free records from Sundays Music. All that in today's episode, plus a special bonus, so make sure you stick around to the end of the episode. And it's all thanks to show sponsor GrooveWasher.com. You have dirty records? Use the Groove Washer to get them clean. Go to GrooveWasher.com today to order your cleaning system for less than $50. And we're also sponsored by Thorns Turntables. You want the best sound? Thorns will help you get it. Check out their brilliant and well-engineered turntables at thorns.com or ask your hi-fi dealer about a Thorns turntable. And with that, let's start today's episode.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, all right. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for today's Vinyl Guide show, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. And wow, today we have a great one for you. It's part one of a two-part conversation with John Tefteller, one of the most extraordinary people in the record collecting game. Now, John resides in the United States, Oregon to be specific, and has one of the most unique record collections on earth. Now, many of his records, particularly his collection of blues 78 RPM shellacs, are some of the only existing copies of these songs. Now, as you may recall from our conversation last week with record mastering engineer Cameron Henry, today recording artists record to tape or hard disk, which is then transferred to a lacquer disk, and records are then duplicated by the thousands. And of course, when those sell out, the record company can once again break out that original tape or hard disk, make another lacquer master, and press out thousands more records. This keeps going and going and going because that master tape exists. Well, 80, 100 years ago, record artists didn't record to tape. It didn't even exist then. They recorded straight to a record, which was then used to duplicate all the others made. So many of those old songs only exist on records that were pressed and distributed. Well, over time, those records get scattered around the country and around the world, and then a lot of them get broken, a lot of them get, you know, melted down or whatever, and many of them these days, unfortunately, do not exist. Well, John Tefteller, the guy we're going to talk to today, hunts for those rare records, and he does something absolutely incredible. When John finds these records, these songs with only one or two copies in existence, he cleans them up, then he shares them with the world. Every year, John puts out a blues calendar, which comes with a CD with all sorts of rare blues songs from records he's acquired, preserved, and made available inside his yearly calendar, which you could order at bluesimages.com. In fact, the calendar itself is really cool, as it has all sorts of old advertisements from all these various records, many of which, again, are the only copies of these advertisements for these records. So it's a great package. It's like, I think, $23. I wholeheartedly encourage you to head over to bluesimages.com, order yourself a calendar, enjoy the CD of rare blues songs that really only exists because of the efforts and seemingly bottomless wallet of John Tefteller. And also, don't forget, Sundazed Music is giving away some records to lucky Vinyl Guide listeners. All you have to do is post a picture or a short video of your favorite record, a short explanation of why it's your favorite record, and of course, put the hashtags hashtag Vinyl Guide and hashtag Sundazed, S-U-N-D-A-Z-E-D, and then you'll be automatically entered to win some records from Sundazed Music. Now, which record should you put up? It's up to you. It could be a collectible record, could be something worth thousands or more dollars. It could be a record that you got in a formative time in your life. I mean, it could be a record that a friend or a loved one got for you. Personally, one of my favorite records is a copy of the Monkees' debut LP on Coal Gems. Now, I had this record as a small child. I wrote all over the label and the record sleeve. It's a record that I could find a much cleaner copy of for, you know, $3 or $5 anywhere. Yet this beat-up copy is my personal treasure, my favorite record. If my house were on fire, this is one of the first things I'd grab. Of course, after my wife and my kids and my insurance paperwork, of course. This Monkees record is one of my favorite records. In fact, I'll upload a photo onto Instagram.com/vinylguide for all of you to take a look at if you're interested. But your favorite record can be any of your choosing. So again, here's what you got to do. Take a picture, or better yet, maybe a 1 or 2 minute video, upload it to Instagram or Facebook telling us why it's your favorite record, and then add the hashtags hashtag Vinyl Guide and hashtag Sundazed before August 26th, 2016, and a few lucky winners will receive some new and awesome records from Sundazed Music. In fact, I encourage you to go to sundazed.com, S-U-N-D-A-Z-E-D.com. Go there now, check out some of their latest releases. Barney Kessel, Live at the Jazz Mill, the Highwaymen Country Supergroup with Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, Waylon Jennings, or maybe the hauntingly lovely vocals of Claudia Thompson, or the fascinating world of John Cage. Whatever it is, you'll always learn something from a Sundazed record. That's sundazed.com, kind of like a record company, except fun and run by music lovers. So with that, let's get to our interview with world-famous record collector John Tefteller right after this word from show sponsors Thorin's Turntables and GrooveWasher.com. The one thing that all record collectors and vinyl enthusiasts have in common are turntables. However, not all turntables are created equal. Do you know that more and more used record stores are starting to warn their customers against those cheapy turntables? Look, it's because cheap turntables can ruin records. And when you invest in records, you want them to last as long as possible and sound as brilliant as possible. And that's why you need a Thorin's turntable. Thorin's turntables are designed and manufactured in Switzerland and Germany. Wonderful engineering with the sole purpose of ensuring high quality sound. Now, Thorin's has turntables for just about any budget, so don't think you need to spend thousands and thousands of dollars. Thorin's has a full line of great sounding turntables that will fit into any budget. So check for yourself. Go to Thorin's.com, T-H-O-R-E-N-S.com. Check them out for yourselves, read the specs, or ask your hi-fi dealer today. Thorin's Turntables, quality which you can hear. Hey everyone, I know you love looking through used record bins and finding gems while digging through crates. Well, I do too, and I often find that the records are quite valuable, but previous owners have kept them for years in less than optimal circumstances. But that's okay. I've got the Groove Washer record cleaning system. So when I find that record that's filthy, covered with dust and grime and God knows what else, I'll give it a blast with the Groove Washer and it'll come out like new. Recently, I found a Mono Columbia 6i Charles Mingus It's a first pressing of one of his great LPs, and I found it for about $5 because it was caked with dirt. The owner kept it in a dusty garage where he kept birds and occasionally used a bandsaw near the records. And over the decades, the records that were in the crate became absolutely caked with muck and dust and debris. Well, within 5 minutes with the Groove Washer, the record looked like new. I posted pictures of it on Instagram. You could check it out yourself. That $5 record is now a $200 record. thanks to the Groove Washer. Now, you'll never know when you'll find a gem just like I did, so make sure you have the Groove Washer in your home. I use the Groove Washer several times a week on my records. It's perhaps the best investment a record collector can make. So get the Groove Washer now for under $50 at groovewasher.com. That's groovewasher.com, and they are made in the USA. So thank you, Thorin's Turntables and groovewasher.com, for sponsoring the Vinyl Guide podcast. Now let's get on to the main event, our conversation with John Tefteller. Again, one of the most renowned record collectors in the world. He's going to talk to us about the rare gems and the adventures that he's had over the years of record collecting. Let's go to our conversation now. So this is Nate, the Vinyl Guide, and I have on the phone a very interesting, remarkable gentleman. You guys have likely heard of him, John Tefteller. Now, John has a remarkable record collection. Somewhere in the number, I believe, John, is it 400,000 records now?
Well, I have 400,000 records, yes, but there are not 400,000 records as a collection. I have a business where I sell records, so that's why there's lots and lots of records here. As far as a personal collection, my personal collection runs about 5,000, and that would be evenly divided between pre- and post-war blues.
Okay, so you're, so 5,000, those are your crown jewels. The other 390-whatever thousand are part of the pool in which you deal on a daily basis.
Correct. That's correct.
I'm fascinated to hear about the 5,000, but where do you get 400,000 records?
Well, when you've been doing it for 40-plus years, they start to accumulate rather quickly. And actually, had I bought everything that was offered to me in the last 45 years, I probably would have 10 times as many as I do. But I don't buy everything that's offered to me, especially these days. I'm pretty selective. Back when I first started, I was a lot more generous with what I would buy and what I would store. But after a while, after 40-some years, you learn very quickly whether what you're storing actually has value and people want it, or whether it's just stuff. And I made the decision some time ago that there was no point in storing just stuff. So whenever I get what I call just stuff, those get disposed of rather quickly because I'm not interested in waking up next year and finding 600,000 records here.
So I'm going to assume that you say no to a lot of records, the Captain and Tennille's and the Anne Murray's, the stuff that will likely be in a landfill. What you have for sale is generally excellent to near mint condition. How do you find rare records in that shape?
Well, you're correct in how you're describing it, and it's not an easy task. Each year that goes by, it gets harder and harder to find mint condition records from 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years ago. It just does. The areas that I focus in run from the mid-1920s up until the late 1960s. I dip a little teeny tiny bit into the early 70s, but I'm pretty much limited to that. So everything here, when you give a number like 400,000 records, everything here is going to be from that time period of between the mid-1920s and the late 1960s. So if you're sort of counting backwards, as much as I don't think it was that long ago, the mid to late 1960s was quite a while ago now. And finding mint records from that time period and before is not something that is getting any easier at all. In fact, it's getting harder and harder every year. But I spend a lot of time cultivating a whole lot of people across the United States that hunt for records out in the wild, is what I call it, out in the wild, And when they discover old caches of brand new records from the 60s or before, I usually wind up hearing about it, and I will go and investigate, and if it's the right kind of thing, I will buy it. But where those records tend to come from, I think, was your question. And because it's been so long, they tend to come from people whose parents, grandparents, in some cases great-grandparents, were somehow involved in the music business itself. They were either worked at a record store, owned a record store, worked at a record distribution company, worked at a radio station, worked in promotion in the business, something where they had access to a very large quantity of records. In cases of the promotion people and the radio station people, those were free records. Back in the 60s and before and into the 70s and all that, but just the period I'm talking about, the record industry was giving out free promotional copies of things in an attempt to get those artists and songs played and get some attention to them, and they would press up copies that were for promotional use, and they would hand them out for free all over the place, trying to make those artists famous, or if they already were famous, trying to make them more famous. And so my job, and the people that I buy records from's job, is to go out, fan out across the United States, and locate people like that, if they're still alive, or their relatives, if they've passed on, and buy up that type of inventory. I'll give you one example, and this is good because this just happened yesterday. I was looking at my computer, and I got a little message from a guy that said, I'm going to send you some pictures, but you need to see this. Okay, so about 2 minutes later, in come some pictures of what looks like a gigantic, almost like an airplane hangar, with boxes, 25 original boxes, 25 count boxes of 78s, with numbers written on the sides, and it goes as far as you can see in these pictures, and they're stacked about 8 to 10 feet high on pallets. And the description that came with it was, here are 750,000 78s in a warehouse on the East Coast. These are brand new from an original store that closed years ago. Are you interested in coming and looking at them? And I will, because who knows what's in that 700, think of that number, 750,000 brand new 78s. They're at least 50, 60 years old because they stopped making 78s in 1960. So they're at least 1960 or before, and there's 750,000 of them. Now, while everybody's kind of jumping up in their chairs here going, what in the world is in it? What in the world is in it that sounds like a gold mine? I have to tell you, I don't think it is. I think it's going to be, out of 750,000, there might be a few thousand that are actually of value in there. Because from what I could tell, looking at the boxes, looking at the numbers that were written on the boxes and the pictures, it's predominantly going to be 90-some percent pop, big band music, easy listening music, something like that. It's not as if somebody discovered a warehouse with 750,000 blues records in it, in which case the market would be flooded, I would be flat broke and totally in debt, and it would be an amazing thing, but I just don't think something like that is possible. I mean, I guess anything's possible, but I wouldn't think I would see somebody sending me pictures of 750,000 brand new 78s in any case, but they did.
That would be an ironic thing to have, is where you find a warehouse full of Blind Blake Paramounts that have not been touched since the 30s.
Well, just to take you off on a little side journey here, since you mentioned that, there actually is indeed a deal like what you're describing. I don't know where it is. I know where it was, and I can tell you the story if you think this will be interesting.
I'm very curious.
Okay. All right. In the late 1920s, there was a man named Winston Holmes, like Sherlock Holmes, H-O-L-M-E-S. and he made two or three records for Paramount with another fellow named Charlie Turner. Winston Holmes lived in the St. Louis, Missouri area. He became a distributor for Paramount and other labels shortly after recording for them. I guess maybe when he went to make his records for Paramount, he said, you know, you need a distributor in St. Louis. I'd be happy to take on that responsibility. And they gave him that responsibility. So here's how this goes. In 1970, 71, right around there, a record collector who is now deceased, but I knew him when he was alive, was wandering around yard sales and estate sales in the St. Louis area. He wandered up to this particular house where they were having a sale. There were no records visible in the sale, but it was an elderly African-American gentleman sitting on the porch. So he wandered up to him and he said, you know, I'm looking for like old records. Would you have anything like that? And the man looked at him and said, yeah, they're all in the house. And he said, okay, what kind of music is it? He says, well, it's all blues and jazz, and it's mainly from the Paramount label. And the guy says, really? And he says, yeah, I used to work for them. And he introduced himself as Winston Holmes, and he proceeded to tell this guy the story about how he had made some records for Paramount and how he had gotten to become a distributor for them. And the collector says, well, would it be all right to look at some? And he goes, yeah, I'll let you in. Come on in. So he gets up, they go in the house, and there are several bedrooms loaded from floor almost all the way up to the ceiling with old brown boxes filled with Paramounts and some other labels. And the guy was looking at this stuff going, uh-oh, this is like insane. These are brand new records. These are Paramounts. These are Blind Blakes, Blind Lemons, Charlie Pattons, everything in the world you could imagine on Paramount in quantity, not just one, but a 25-count box or more of each title, all in original sleeves. So he turns to Mr. Winston Holmes and he says, I'm interested in all these records. What would you consider selling all these records to me for? And he said that Holmes looked at him and said, I don't know, hadn't really thought about that. I've sold a few here and there since the company went bankrupt and all that to people that happen to know that I have them and all that, and I've sold them for, you know, the old retail price of 50 cents or 75 cents. He said, I don't know. I don't even know how many of these things are here, but there's an awful lot. How about this? How about, I think the price was, not, this is where I'm a little hazy as to what it was, but I think it was either $500 or $2,000 for that house full of records. The collector looked at him and said, that's fine. I'll be happy to do that. I don't have the money on me. I'm going to have to get it. It'll take me a few days. This guy was not, you know, this is, again, 1969, 1970. He's not walking around with more than 10 or 20 bucks in his pocket, and he doesn't have a lot of money to buy records with in the first place. But anyway, 2 weeks later, and that's where this gets bad, this gentleman waited 2 weeks to go back to that house. He goes back 2 weeks later. The house is empty. No sign of Winston Holmes. No sign of any records anywhere. And all he could figure out was that the yard sale was something where they were selling out and moving, but there was no way of being able to tell where they moved to or what happened to that load of records. He asked the neighbors, and the neighbors said, oh, I don't know, they just moved. I don't know where. And that was the end of that stock of records. So I am convinced that to this day, somewhere in the St. Louis area, it is very possible that that load of records still exists in the hands of someone who is either a relative or a friend of Winston Holmes. I don't think they threw them out, but they could have.
Well, at some point, they would have popped up by now. I mean, even...
Well, you would think that, but stranger things have happened. You would have thought that this load of 750,078 in a warehouse would have popped up before, but it doesn't. what happens with these things is sometimes they just get buried. And they stay buried until a generation or two later when somebody comes in and says, gee, I don't think we want to store this stuff anymore. We should probably look into it and see if it's worth any money, or we should shovel it off to the dump and get rid of it. Last week, I was in a town not far from where I live in Oregon, and I don't find much here in Oregon. Most of what I find is outside of this area. But I had a call from somebody who said, you need to go check this out. There's a house full of 78s in Oregon you need to go look at. So I drove up there, and I went there, and this was a collection of a man who had collected primarily, and I say primarily because there were a few other things in there, but primarily country records from the 30s to the late 50s, right in there. It was all 78s, and they were floor to ceiling on shelves in two or three rooms of a house, and they had not been touched since he passed away in 1994. They were still there, and he had collected them back starting in the mid-40s up to the sometime in the 70s or 80s when he gave up looking for 78s and stopped. But nobody had been in that house since then. Nobody had touched the records since then. The son is in a different business, and the way he put it, the records aren't eating anything. They're just sitting here. I don't need to sell them. They're here.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only reason I think I got to look at them is because if someone he knew said, well, you know, you should have somebody come in there and at least look and see if there's anything of significant value here. You may not want to sell it, but there might be something historically significant value here, and they might want to use it for something or whatever. And so he agreed under those conditions to let me have a look. Well, I didn't buy anything because I could tell right away that he really didn't want to sell anything, and the records were his father's, and they were important to his father, and for some reason they were still important to him. But as I was leaving, there was what would have been a granddaughter outside, and she was probably in her mid to late 20s, and she seemed very disappointed that I didn't buy anything. And it was like, well, we got this whole house full of records here. It won't mean a thing to me. If you want them, I wish my dad would have just sold them to you. So what that tells me is the third generation is not going to hang on to those records, and when the son is gone and passed away, that granddaughter will be selling those for whatever she can get just as fast as she can. But things get buried, and they stay buried for decades sometimes.
So you've made your living, your history, your reputation on finding and owning some of the rarest records in the world. And you specialize in pre-war blues, primarily at labels like Paramount, I guess Black Patty, a few other very
well, old labels. Well, anything that's good from that time period. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be Paramount. It doesn't have to be Black Patty. In fact, with Black Patty, there's a lot of records on Black Patty that aren't very good. They're extraordinarily rare, but they're not very good. I don't collect records that are extraordinarily rare and lousy. I have a few simply because I have them. But when it comes to paying big bucks for those things, the last thing I want to do is pay thousands of dollars for a rare record that sounds terrible. And I don't mean the quality of the playback. I mean the quality of the performance.
Right. So it's rarity plus taste.
Yeah, it has to have some kind of musical value. And I'm not concerned necessarily with rarity, although rarity is fun and rarity is important and all of that. You want to save things, or I want to save things for history, and I want to find things that no one's ever found before and make them available and all that stuff. But I have records that are valued well under $100 that are just as enjoyable in their own way as records that are valued at $10,000 and $20,000. It just depends on how many copies were made, how many sold, and how many still exist. But I'm not a record snob in that I only have to have super, super rare and unusual things. I just am trying to complete a genre of things, pretty much the pre-war blues period, because that's the most interesting period to me. But I'm not interested in buying every single record that came out in that time period, because that time period, just like every other time period, has its share of clunkers as well as great records, too.
I'm going to assume that collecting records will be your, it will continue to be your interest, no matter how deep or how complete your collection gets.
Well, you're never done.
Right. Right.
I don't know of anybody who's set out to do anything like this who can honestly say that they completed it from start to finish. No matter what you try to do, there will always be, and this is in coins, this is in stamps, this is in baseball cards, this is in any field of collectible, whatever you set out to accomplish, there's always going to be some thing or some group of things that you simply cannot find, or you simply cannot own, even if you can find them, because the people that own them, there might only be one or two known copies, and those people don't want to sell them, and so you can't complete whatever you're trying to do. So as long as I have interest in records and am breathing and am in good health, I will continue to hunt them down, but I don't ever expect to be finished, so to speak, and I don't know that anybody can finish.
So what are the records that continue to elude you?
Well, there's lots of records that continue to elude me. A more interesting way to pose it might be, what are the really great records that continue to elude?
What records do you want a phone call to come in today and say, look, I found these three records?
Okay. Well, it's pretty simple. I am known as the Paramount guy because I have more Paramount blues records than anybody else, just because I've been buying and buying and buying them over a fairly long period of time. And I have managed to, during that period of time, find a half a dozen or more of them that had never previously been found. They were not known to exist. It was known that they were pressed, but no copies had been found. And I managed to come up with those. So we are down to now, I guess there's anywhere from a half a dozen to a dozen or so Paramount records that are probably going to be pretty darn good, although we don't know till we find them and hear them, but we can tell by the artists and the titles that they probably are going to be good. And of that half a dozen to dozen or so, the top ones for me would be two records by Willie Brown, which have been missing for decades and decades, and there are also two records by J.D. Short that are still missing. There's possibly a Skip James and or Sunhouse missing, but we don't know for sure. There may be a Patton missing, but we don't know for sure. And when I say we don't know for sure, I don't want to get everybody's hopes up here. The problem with it is we don't necessarily know what some of those releases were because they're holes in the discography. There's missing numbers for that label that are in the right time period to have a Skip James or a Sunhouse or a Charlie Patton or something like that. But until that number is located, or an advertisement or a catalog or some kind of a thing telling us what that number was, we don't know. But so there may be. When I say maybe, there may be. We don't know. The ones we know for sure are two records by Willie Brown, Paramount 13096, which is Kicking in My Sleep Blues, and Paramount 13001, which is Grandma Blues. I can tell you for sure those were pressed. Can't tell you where they are, and those would be the two that I would want the most. And I have a standing offer out there of $25,000 for either of those two records in any playable condition. And by that, they can have a chunk out of the edge, they can be cracked, but they have to be playable.
So you say you buy records in any condition. Have you ever bought a broken record?
Yes. I've bought broken records, cracked records, damaged records, but these are extraordinarily rare records. There is no point in buying a cracked, broken, or damaged record, of which there are multiple ways to buy it when it's not cracked, broken, or damaged. So when I say I buy a cracked, broken, or damaged record, it's going to be something that's a one-of-a-kind type thing. And when you get down to that, it's a choice of either having it lost for the ages, or saving what you can out of it.
Now, when you do an acquisition and the record is in poor shape, I'm assuming quite a few of them are pretty rough when you get them, how do you restore them?
Well, I actually don't. That's not my thing. My thing is locating the records. My thing is going out there and searching through the barns and the warehouses and the mm-hmm. the attics and the basements. But my thing is not repairing damaged records. There's a fellow in Los Angeles area named Jim Cooperrider, and he has been doing this for 40-some years. He is the best in the world at repairing damaged records. If he can't fix it, it is not fixable. There's no way. And he's really, really good at it. They hired him to restore the audio discs for the Jazz Singer when they were doing the Blu-ray reissue. They wanted to restore the actual discs to the soundtrack, and they were broken in multiple pieces, and he put them all back together like a puzzle, made them play, and they were able to restore them from that. So there are people out there, this one gentleman in particular, but there's others, that are really good at restoration, and I prefer to just pay people who are good at it than try to figure it out myself when I can be out there doing other things.
So logistically, when it comes to, you get a phone call that says, we've got this airplane hangar of 750,000 78s. Logistically, how do you do that? Do you have a team that just surrounds
No.
the building for a week?
No. I have a team of zero. Well, a team of one, me. No, there's no team. I have to actually go there and spend as much time as I feel like spending until I feel like I've exhausted any nuggets that can be pulled from the mine, so to speak. And if it takes a few days or a few weeks, I just do what I need to do until it's done. And if I look at it for a day or two and figure, wow, this is nothing but a big mountain of stuff that no one's going to care about, then I just walk away from the deal.
So you go out there, you've got your gloves on, you just start going through the boxes, and then you make an educated guess at some point to say whether you continue and look at every single record or whether you just stop and
usually I will look at every single record. However, there are instances in which I don't. And the instances in which I don't are real simple, when I can tell that someone else has already done exactly that. If I go there and I start seeing absolutely nothing but things of little or no value, and I talk to the owner and say, you know, was somebody else here before me? And they say, yeah, there was a guy here about 20 years ago, and he took a big pile of them. At that point, I walk out the door because I know that anything that was any good walked out of that building 20 years ago.
Fair enough.
There's always a chance that they missed something, but the time is precious, and you don't want to invest your time just going through other people's leftovers. It just doesn't make any sense. The only time it works is sometimes in 45s, if it's a case where there was an R&B vocal group collector there, but he didn't care about rockabilly, or he didn't care about soul music or whatever it is, and so he only took what he wanted, and he left everything else of value there. Now, that kind of thing went on a lot in the 60s and into the 70s, but by the time you get into the 80s and 90s and present day, people don't leave stuff like that behind. They've figured out real quick that if they don't want it, somebody else does, and they can turn it into money, so they don't leave things behind. If there's anything good there, they take it, and away it goes. So, but the early guys, the guys who were doing it in the 60s and early 70s, they didn't have a lot of money, and they were very focused on what they wanted, and they took what they wanted, and they left behind things that now are quite valuable and interesting. So if that's the case, then I will go through it. But if I get told, no, somebody was here within the last 10 or 20 years and pulled out whatever, I know that all the good records are gone and there's no point in me continuing to look through them. Now, I try to avoid even going to look at things like that. So I try to, like, ask a lot of questions ahead of time. Has anybody else been through this? When has anybody else been through this? What were they looking for? What were they buying? And if I get the wrong answers, then I don't go.
So tell me a story or two about some of your favorite unexpected finds. apologies, everyone, for the cliffhanger. But again, that was part one of our two-part interview with John Tefteller, world-famous record collector and all-around good guy. Part two will be up next week. However, as a bit of a bonus for the Vinyl Guide audience, John has agreed to share some of the music with you all. Just a taste of what he loves and hopefully to put a smile on your face. The track I'm about to play is by Blind Willie Johnson, and it's called When the War Was On. This song was recorded on December 11th, 1929 in New Orleans and was pressed and distributed by Columbia Records, catalog number 14545-D. Now, what Blind Willie is referring to was then known as the Great War. Of course, we now call it World War I. He even name-checks the Kaiser and President Wilson by name. The woman in the recording may have been, it's believed to have been, Blind Willie Johnson's first wife. However, we're not entirely clear on that, but what we do know is this song was featured on the Blues Images CD, and a full-page advertisement by Columbia Records from 1929 is shown in full glory in the calendar itself. So again, I highly recommend everyone head over to bluesimages.com, order yourself a copy of the Blues Images calendar and CD. Again, they're like, I think, $22, $23, and man, is it interesting and enjoyable. So again, thanks to all the preservation efforts of John Tefteller and his team from 1929, here's Blind Willie Johnson's When the War Was On.
Everybody well.
When the war was on.
Everybody well.
When the war was on.
Everybody well.
When the war was on.
When the reddest of a body when the war was on. Well, it just about a few years, some months ago. United States come and voted for war. Damn it, called a man from the east and the west. They ride a board, we got to do our best. Have a battle well.
When the war was on.
Have a battle well.
When the war was on.
Have a battle well.
When the war was on.
Well, the reddest ever battle when the war was on. Well, President Wilson sitting on his throne. Making laws for call a black man, leave out the wine. Sugar for a personal week. Folks didn't like it, they blamed Uncle Sam. I got to save the sugar for the boys in France. Everybody well.
When the war was on.
Everybody well.
When the war was on.
Everybody well.
When the war was on.
Well, the reddest everybody when the war was on. Well, boys whooped the Germans on Madeleine. Would have brought the Kaiser for the run to.
Great record. And again, many, many more songs like that are available on the Blues Images CD and calendar. Order yours today at bluesimages.com. And thanks to John for allowing us to play that. Tune in next week for part two of our interview with John Tefteller. And make sure to enter our Sundays to Music favorite record contest. All you need is a picture or a short video posted to Instagram and social media with the hashtags Vinyl Guide and Sundays. Do it before Friday, August 26th, and you may be the lucky person receiving a package of records from Sundays Music. Don't forget to tune in next week. Until then, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.